Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a Heat Rock, an album that sears its way into our collective memory. And today, we will be taking it back to 1969 with Stan, the Juggernaut album by Sly and the Family Stone. When San Francisco's Sylvester Stewart and his Family Stone released Stand in the spring of 1969, it further cemented the group's reputation as the definitive pop act of the era, whose multiracial makeup mirrored the band's multi-musical fluency in rock, pop, soul, and funk. They captured the post-Summer of Love optimism of the times in songs like Everyday People and You Can Make It If You Try. And though those good times wouldn't last in the years to follow, for that brief, shining moment, Stan thrust Sly and the Family Stone into the spotlight as avatars for a national feeling of possibility and positivity. Can it be it was all so simple back then?
Stan was the album pick of our guest today, singer-songwriter B. Beeman. Releasing a new album is noteworthy, an accomplishment worth celebrating, and I do. I celebrate efforts, especially when the release is interesting, innovative, a game-changer. But yo, what's more game-changing than releasing your album as a podcast? I'll wait. That's that new, and that's what our guest just did. His latest just-released album, Peace of Mind, is released on the Critical Frequency Network, a podcast network, quote, for everyone else. That's cool. But everyone else isn't doing this, taking a fresh look at music consumption and coming up with something cool. But the goal here was to add volume and depth to the listening experience, to let the music simmer and saute, something sorely needed in a time of microwave entertainment. Thanks, B. He was born in the Lou, built in the Bay, and carries a gang of musical influences in his pocket, folk and soul, rock, and the hippie grenade. Some folks would rather do, and some folks would rather just be. B. Beeman, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Wow, can I keep that? Can I do that every time I go out on stage?
Absolutely.
That was amazing.
Need that money, though.
Oh.
There's always a catch. No, I was just playing with you.
Yeah.
Welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this one.
Same here. And let's start with this then. How did you first come across this album?
Probably my older brother's influence and his friends brought a CD into the house. I can't quite, it was teenage years, 16 or something.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I liked political music, like Rage Against the Machine was there, but that's very angry sounding. And then there's Bob Dylan, who's very introspective. And then Sly was political, but irreverent and virtuosic, all these things. And it was all these things at once. And it was lighthearted in a way, even though he's talking about crazy, heavy things. The way we saw music through his lens and his political views through his lens was uplifting. It wasn't beating you over the head, and it was made you feel good, really.
Right. Like
you can make it if you try, all these things, you know.
Was that your introduction to Sly in general?
Yeah. Stan was my introduction, the snare roll at the top of the song.
Yeah.
Iconic to me. And, you know, I got into There's a Riot Going On, and Fresh is like one of my favorite albums. But this one is really special. I'm sure it's special to a lot of people in a lot of the same ways, but this one's very perfect, I guess you could say, in a lot of ways.
Right.
And I read about how he was very clean at that moment. He was very focused. He was looking at, referencing his production orchestration, like books that he had around, and he wasn't doing coke and doing things like that. And then, so he was like, this was very sharp. You know, this album was super sharp. I wasn't born yet, so I don't really know what was going on. This is just what I read.
My introduction to Sly and the Family Stone, not this album, but Sly and the Family Stone in general, I didn't hear this around the house. Mm-hmm. My introduction came through the documentary for Woodstock, which I watched maybe my first year in college. I don't know how I came across it. It might have been like there used to be this thing called a video store where you could, you know, rent DVDs. And I think I grabbed it that way. And obviously, as you know, it's a really long documentary, and there's, you know, all these great performances, but I just remember what stood out to me, besides Richie Havens, and obviously Joe Cocker was Sly. And I was just like, wow, it's like 3:30 in the morning, and here comes this dude, and he, I mean, he does like a 14-song set, but everyone's like, hi, and he's like killing to dance to the music, and I'll never forget, I Want to Take You Higher. And that has resonance with this album, of course, but I remember watching him perform that, thinking how similar how that song sounded was to music that I'd heard growing up in the church, how he played the organ, just the build of the song, the call and response of the song, the going on and on and on was very churchy. And I grew up similarly Baptist and Kojic, and so that had resonance. So that was my introduction to Sly. And what an introduction it was, if that's your start.
I don't remember for this album in particular. I mean, I think like a lot of people, I would have grown up listening to songs like Everyday People and a lot of their big hits as singles. And I don't think I really had a real Sly era until I was much older, and mostly reading about songs and socially engaged and politically engaged albums of the era. And Sly is obviously very, very high up there, given all the work that him and the Family Stone were putting out in the late 60s and early 70s. A few years ago, I was given the task, and this is, I think, was for Rolling Stone's website, to put together a list of the 20 Sly Stone essential songs, which means I basically had to do a deep dive through the entire catalog. And that was really a huge crash course lesson for me, because as much as I knew things in passing about the group and about Sylvester in particular, it was the first time I really made a concerted effort to sit through a lot of their, I mean, really just his entire, both the band and his solo catalog. And I think partly coming out of that deep dive, I just needed a break. And so until B picked this song, I actually had not gone back to Stan. And I think the last 3-4 years since putting that together, but it was a real pleasure to kind of revisit like this kind of old friend of an album. And yeah, I think I don't think you can ever accuse Sly and the Family Stone of being particularly didactic. And certainly with other artists of the era, they tended to wear their politics on their sleeves a little bit more explicitly or obviously. I mean, it's not like Sly was a king of subtlety, especially in a song like, you know, Don't Call Me Whitey,
exactly, right?
But that said, there's a lot. It's not politics that are being worn in the sleeve there. And it also got me thinking, too, on that note, is, in some ways, I don't know if it's fair to say that we collectively at times maybe forget the politics of the group, because their biggest hits tend to be these super shiny, meticulously studio marvels that Sly helped to oversee. But in the process, we sort of maybe at times lose the social political context in which Sly first came up in San Francisco of the 1960s, and then what him and the group put together in that entire era, and then through the early 1970s as he goes off on the deep end in multiple ways. Do you think this is sort of the kind of the curse of the greatest hits, is over-defining a group to the cost of some of the other layers that we could talk about?
That's a deep question. I don't know if I can answer that one, but probably there's some truth to that, probably on the surface level. I would say something that was impactful to me and their politics and their music and everything, but even if you just look at them as a band.
Right.
Yeah.
White, black, Latin in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I mean, Santana kind of had a similar type of amalgam of things, but he didn't sing political things like Sly did. And just looking at them was different. And that was a statement like, oh, this guy's inclusive.
Right.
Right off the bat. Like, or this band is inclusive. This music is inclusive. So that was an appeal to me, just on a very surface level.
And not just in the look. I mean, obviously, if you look at a press photo of the album covers, that the multiracial nature of the band sticks out. But the use of voices, let alone on this album, is that you always are hearing these multiple layers and everyone's voices coming in, both in harmony and also having their own little solo bits over the course of different songs. To me, that's also really striking, is because you don't hear that same kind of multivalent vocality. I'm being way too academic right now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just don't necessarily hear that same blend of voices from other pop acts in that same era.
I think it's probably has to do with Sly probably didn't have much of an ego. He was like, I want this band to be the best, and A lot of bands are probably like, no, I'm the dude. Nobody's singing. You're not going to sing. You'll sing back up to me or whatever. But he literally you can tell he enjoyed letting everybody shine, whether it's taking trumpet solos, guitar solos, whatever, bass solos, a bass solo. Larry Graham, obviously.
Sure.
Rose Stone. Sorry, I'm forgetting names right now. But
Cynthia Robinson.
Cynthia Robinson. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing voices on their own. And he knew that and whatever. And like, maybe we're giving too much credit to Sly for like letting his amazing band play, but he did. And it was about the band. It was about fun. It was about the experience.
Something had changed between A Whole New Thing, which I think comes out in 67, fall of 67. So by the time we get to Stand, obviously there's some things that have gone on politically that have affected him and made him more conscious. But even if you look at the album covers, something has changed between A Whole New Thing and this. And it's not just 3 years. Sly has gone from the short fro and the little Happy Days sweater to Sly is different,
letting it loose, yeah.
He's letting it loose. And I wondered if you had any insight to what might have been happening in his career. Was this a change? Like, was this a studio construct, or was this Sly was like, this is me? Because clearly something's different.
I don't know. I think it was him. I don't think it was studios or whatever. I think it was like, this was him being fun. And there's a concert of him, I don't know, maybe it was Dick Cavett, one of these old late night shows where he just jumps out in the audience and he's running up in the audience singing, I Want to Take You Higher, and bring it back down. And that was unusual. You know, the cameras don't usually turn back 180 back in that day. I think it was him. I think it was experimentation of drugs that's well documented. But at the same time, I don't know. That, like I said, I read something about how he was very well put together during that Stand album. So maybe there's obviously different drugs
sure.
that do different things to you. And so I don't know, but I mean, his mind opened for sure in a great way. And he had been producing records in SF for a long time. So his production chops were being honed. I don't know. I think it was like a lot of things too.
I would also add, and I don't want to overly romanticize what it was like to have been in the Bay in that era, but I think in general, because the Bay Area has, of course, a very vibrant, longstanding musical community and tradition, but because it's not in New York and it's not in Los Angeles, it's away from the centers of the music industry, I think there's a certain degree of freedom that artists have to play around that would be different if this same band had come up in one of those other cities, where I think the pressures to produce a certain kind of, you know, conventionality would have been much more present than it might have been for these guys.
Because,
I mean, you look at everything they did prior to this album, and they get to play with a lot of different ideas.
They do.
It doesn't feel like it's being overly directed by some A&R.
No, but it's just that there's a striking difference between the image, on the first album, and this. I didn't know if he had just come into his own, or if that's what he needed, if he needed to be buttoned up to get into the game, because there's only a 3-year difference, a year difference between that first
album. Well, you could say there's a lot of things that happened between, was it 67 you're saying?
Yeah.
I mean, 68, RFK and MLK were shot.
Yep.
That was obviously a major moment. And there's all the Summer of Love, all this hippie stuff happening. I'm not a historian on that, but he's living in the epicenter of San Francisco.
Right. Haight Ashbury.
That's obviously probably a huge thing. But whatever he did a good job.
Yes, he did. He did. And civil rights is still burning bright, but it's gotten away from civil rights and moved more into black power. And so things are changing, and he's got that hippie element. So I was just looking at all of the albums on Discogs last night, and I was like, yo, Sly's looking different around this third, fourth album. What's the first song from that album that you're attracted to?
The message of Stand and Everyday People was just the introduction. That was like the first thing I probably heard, because it's simple to digest, I guess you could say. But my favorite, like most indelible song is Sing a Simple Song. We were talking about that earlier.
Right.
And I might have heard that on Band of Gypsies, like Jimi Hendrix in one of his shows. He just starts going, dee doo 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 dee doo dee dee doo doo dee doo 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 doo. And then he starts doing something else. And I was like, oh, that's just, he must be a Sly fan. I was like, okay. Yeah. He didn't say anything about it during the show. He just started doing it.
Yeah.
But as a guitar player, Sly offered quite a few riffs for me to like glean something from or just rip intentionally, whatever it is. Freddie Stone. Great guitar player. And I love when he sings. Whenever his voice pops up, it's like a joyous overload for me because I'm going to play a little guitar, whatever he says. It's so funny. I think singing a simple song was like, wow.
Yeah.
Because it made me feel good. It was like self-healing or something in that regard. But it was political, but it really wasn't political. It was personal political, I guess you could say. It was like about like people on the internet and Twitter, you hear about self-love day or whatever the hell, you know, take care of yourself.
Sure.
This was that to me. Talking. I'm walking.
Oliver, you? Is there a song off the album that you fell for at first listen, or?
Oh, I would have to say it would also be Sing a Simple Song.
Okay.
And, you know, normally we talk about the fire track in the back half of the episode, but since we're already here, I mean, let's just say, this is definitively, like, it's not even like the definitive fire track for Sly and the Family Stone. It's like, if you look up in some kind of dictionary fire track, this should be the single that appears because every element about it, the build, the repeated builds, or the ways in which it uses the drumming, the guitar, I mean, the whole rhythmic propulsiveness of it is just so irresistible. And a few years ago, myself and Joe Schloss, who is an ethnomusicologist back east, he basically helped dissect the song because there are layers to it I'd never really paid attention to, even though it must have been there always, which is, number one, there's a lot of use of stereo panning on the song, and so all the drums are actually in the right channel, and then I forget which instruments are on the left. But one reason why this song, and Morgan, I know you always like to talk about sampling, I mean, this is one of the most heavily sampled songs, sure, period, in hip-hop, and part of it is because since they buried the drums in the right channel, all you had to do was just pan over, and you have this semi-clean drum break, which has just got that huge big kick to it and the snare hit. And the other thing too, and I was thinking about this in one of B's earlier points, is that the sort of irreverency and the studio meticulousness on this one song, you can hear it there, not just because of the panning and all these other effects they do, but they even joke about the fact that, like, I'm overdubbing. Like, they kind of drop it in at the tail end of the song, which I'd never even heard. I never really paid attention to that line until my friend Joe pointed out when he led me through this song dissection. It's like, it's so meta. They're drawing attention to their own studio techniques on a song that is otherwise like this just fire dance single, right?
I love singles, simple song, but I like Stand. Mm-hmm. I think it has some of the greatest liners in a song that I've heard.
Mm.
There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. I mean, come on, dude. I mean, it's like, yo, if you say that to somebody, that's pretty tough. Like, you're morally wrong, and also there's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. But I like that that it's very global about, to me, about taking a stand for yourself, but it also seems very personal. For black men in the 60s, who obviously has seen some things in the world, I love the way he sings on the song. I love just the simplicity of Stand. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. Stand. There's a midget standing tall. And the giant. And again, to your point earlier about the great voices, I mean, it's not just Sly, it's just the hard, flat-footed singing of the women in the group. And I think we should make a point about Little Sister and some of the background vocalists, which were really strong, very gospel-based. One of the background singers in the earlier years was a gospel singer named Tremaine Hawkins, who went on to be a solo artist. She married Walter Hawkins, but she had a great solo career. Oh, But you have, I mean, it is the Family Stone, so it's not just Sly, but it's these great, great, pure voices from everywhere. Everyone can sing. I love the presence of the women in the band, not just Cynthia Robinson, which is badass because who was really playing the trumpet like that in the band, you know, with the ill afro, right? Yeah. And just playing. And then, of course, his sister, who was also an instrumentalist and also singing too. So Stand is my favorite because I like when they get to that. I can't sing, but you know, when they get to that stand.
It's funny.
Cut that out. Don't have me singing on there. But I love that.
We'll auto-tune that.
Yes, please. Thank you.
When it goes into that outro, that part's all super hype, and I was reading about it, you know, before coming on here today, and some of the band members like, why is this song, why don't we just get to that? Like, they didn't really, like, love the awesomeness of the Stand part of it.
Sure.
Because it was, like, boring to them as players, right?
Oh, no.
And they wanted to get to the fun part, but I'm glad they didn't do that.
That's funny. If I can just pull the scope back a little bit, we were talking about trying to think about this album within the larger context of both social history in of the United States, of course, in the late 60s. But I always think about the difference between this album and then There's a Riot Going On, which comes 2 years later and comes after Sly has basically dipped into darkness on multiple levels. And the tone of the of those two albums could not be more distinct, partly because of it, just both in terms of its content and certainly as well as musically as well. And I was trying to think of any other example of how two different albums back to back, and I'm a little bit cheating here because there was the Greatest Hits LP that came out in 1970. I think that's between these two albums. But since that was not a new studio album, even though it had what Everybody is a Star and Hot Fun in the Summertime was added to that. But if we exclude the Greatest Hits, you got this album, you got There's a Riot Going On, and it's two snapshots of an artist and of a group in two very, very different spaces, which, again, I think also mirrors kind of America's optimism of the late 60s, which is quickly dying, and then you're kind of dipping into, like, Nixonian dystopia by the early 70s. Yeah. Can we think of another pair of albums that offers that kind of deep, deep contrast?
You know, that's a good question, because when I think of, you know, the first thing that came to mind, and obviously it doesn't have heavy political weight, so I'm hesitant to even say this, but the first thing that came to mind was the difference between Mary J. Blige's What's the 411 and Mary J. Blige's My Life. Mm-hmm. And something different that had happened to her between the first album and the second album. So the first album was, you know, the official, you know, she has come out as the queen of hip hop soul. It's dance, he's got a lot of rap, it's got a lot of features.
Yeah.
And between the first album and My Life, something has happened. Something, you know, traumatic in her relationship. Mm-hmm. There have been allegations of drug use. Mm. And so My Life is just that. It's sort of her explanation of, this is why I've been gone, this is what's happening to me. And it's not bouncy like that. It's not all hip hop. It's almost completely 60s and 70s sample based. And it's just all these stories of woe, and this is what I've been going through, these changes, and da-da-da-da. That's the first thing that came to mind. I'm sure there's a lot of smart people out there that have other albums, but that's the first thing that came to mind. It's a difference.
Right.
You're either a What's the 411 Mary, or you're a My Life Mary.
Yeah.
And some people didn't get into Mary until My Life, so they're like, what's the 411?
Yeah.
But What's the 411 was the introduction of a genre. Heretofore, we didn't know about hip-hop soul.
Right.
She was the introduction.
Though I think in that case, and not to go too far off on a Mary J. tangent, though why not? It's also that What's the 411 is a young person's album. Like, this is clearly someone who's at the beginning, kind of finding her proverbial voice. My Life is she's been through some shit, right? She's more grown out of it.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be different if Stan was the group's first album, but it was their fourth album.
It was.
Like they've been putting out music for well over, you know, half a decade. And Sly himself, I think, was recording back in like the late 50s as a kid. So this is not something where Stan is like that bright-eyed, optimistic first album that you could say, you know, the equivalent of, let's say, 3 Feet High and Rising for De La.
Sure, sure.
And then De La Soul is Dead is the, we've seen some industry shit and we're going to talk about it. This is like, we're at the height of our pop success. It's post-Summer of Love. We represent the Bay Area and all of this kind of social, cultural optimism that comes out of it. And then we do a lot of coke and some other shit, and America Goes to Hell. And then we put out an album 2 years later when we're even more mature, musically speaking, but tonally something very different.
Something different, yeah.
I'm sure there must be other groups that fit into that, but this contrast between Stan and There's a Riot Going On is just, it just haunts me because it is such a notable shift.
Sure.
And it's hard to think of too many other examples where you see that manifesting.
Okay. Sure. And I almost thought, because there are only three albums, I thought, well, maybe I don't want to go here. Because I almost said Brown Sugar versus Voodoo. I almost said, because there's so much time between the first and the second one, that they're completely different. But
right.
That's a lot of time.
Right.
It was a lot of time, yeah.
We'll have to do a future show that just revisits like fourth and fifth albums. So,
yeah. Hopefully he's got a fifth album.
No, yeah. I don't mean for D'Angelo. I just mean like...
Oh, in general.
Right,
yeah.
Right, since that's what we're doing. We're analyzing the fourth and fifth album of a person's catalog.
Yes. Yeah. We'll be back with more of our conversation with B. Beeman on Sly Stone's Stand after a brief word from a couple of great Max Fun podcasts. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is Wonderful.
It's a podcast that we do as we are married. And how's the ad going so far? Because I think it's going very good.
We talk about things we like every week on Wednesdays.
One time Rachel talked about pumpernickel bread. It was so tight. You cannot afford to miss her talking about this sweet brown bread.
We also talk about music and poems and, you know, weather.
There was one... Weather? One time Rachel talked about Baby Beluga, this song, for like 14 minutes. And it just really blew my hair back.
So check us out on MaximumFun.org.
It's a cool podcast with chill vibes. Amber is the color of our energy, is what all the iTunes reviews say.
They will now.
Listen, we already know that you love genre movies, film craft, and female filmmakers. So if you love all those things, then by transitive property, you love my podcast, Switchblade Sisters. Hi, I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I have a conversation with a different female filmmaker about their favorite genre film. Each episode covers the filmmaking process, working in the film industry, and just like... general geeking out about awesome movies. I've had such great guests like the Big Sick writer Emily Gordon.
To me, indie movies as of late have come to be a catch-all term for a movie that kind of defies genre.
Billy Madison and Half-Baked director Tamara Davis.
When a comedian comes and enters onto my set, they're just there to be funny, and we're all ready and waiting for them to be funny.
Horror industry veteran and actor Barbara Crampton.
That's where real drama lies for me. What's between you and I speaking right now? Where are we meeting? And what's the energy that we create between us?
And so many others. So check out Switchblade Sisters every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Heat Rocks. Our guest today is singer-songwriter B. Beeman, and we are talking about Sly and the Family Stone's 1969 smash album, Stand.
Sex Machine. Let's get into it.
All right.
Long song.
Very long.
13 plus.
All instrumental. What'd you think about it?
I love instrumental. When the band is good, I love instrumental music. So I'm a big Booker T and the MGs fan.
Sure.
So I could listen to instrumentals all day long. And their instrumentals are funky and weird and using new technology at the time and using vocoders and using whatever they were using. I don't know what they were using. But it was funky and it was different and they didn't care and I didn't care either.
You know, it was a trip to me because in prep for the chat, I was like, well, let me just let the album run. And so I just let it run, had it up loud. And at some point I was like, wait, I don't know that I didn't remember that this song was this long, but this song is still going. Like, I've washed my dishes, I've come back in the living room, and this song is still going. What I liked about it is everything that you mentioned, just the instrumental nature of it, that it felt like, you know, the musicians, the guitar going back and forth, the fuzz, everything that I like. Is it weird for this album? I don't know, but I just wasn't expecting to have an instrumental song that long in this album. But to the points that we were making earlier, that he has this great band. Why not take advantage of... Right. Why not pull that muscle if you've got it? It ain't tricking if you got it. So, and let's mention some of his musicians before we get out, before we move on. We obviously have Larry Graham, Gregorico, Jerry Martini, Cynthia Robinson. I'm probably missing a few. It also made me think of his appearance on Soul Train. And he comes on Soul Train, and before Sly comes on the stage, there's like three, he's not on the stage yet. Don Cornelius throws to him and says, okay, whatever, Sly and the Family Stone. And so I'm thinking Sly's going to jump out. It's not Sly. It's just the band. And there's 2 or 3 minutes before Sly gets on, but they're just jamming and they're killing. And to me, I want to go back to some of the churchy elements. Is the party always starts with the organist, and there's when a praise break starts, you come off of the sermon, and then before you usher everyone into pandemonium, Holy Ghost pandemonium, it's just instrumentation, and it sounds so familiar. So by the time they've gone about 3 or 4 minutes, and you got Cynthia and she's grooving and everyone's playing, then miraculously up jumps Sly. Cynthia's gone from side to side. His sister's killing. And on Sex Machine, it's just a long flex of this is what I have in my back pocket. So we're going to play this thing.
If I can just nitpick, and this is perhaps because I'm too influenced by the sound of James Brown's song Sex Machine.
Sure.
This song does not sound like it should be entitled Sex Machine. <There's
nothing laughs> you should about think about it the JBs. Yeah.
It doesn't sound that sexy or no. Like a machine of sex. I don't know. Whenever it comes on, I look at the song title and I just keep anticipating something different than what I'm getting. Again, not to nitpick a song title.
No, but that's real, yeah. Though. That's real. No, that's...
Awful Sex Machine is what it should be called.
Vanilla Sex Machine. Not as sexy Sex Machine. Oh man!
That's sort of a trick, right? To have your band open a few minutes before you.
Yeah,
but that's sometimes it's a kind of an older trick, and I've been open for like B.B. King, and that he did that. But it's a lot of times done for health reasons for the main act.
Yeah,
they're like older or whatever.
Oh sure.
But then there's the showmanship aspect that Sly was doing.
And that's what I thought.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And it was dope. And then he comes on, and he's got his jacket on. He's got these big glasses. He's got his, he got the mutton chops. You know how he was looking about.
And he always takes an organ solo or something and kills it.
Oh, yeah.
It's so amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of which, we spent time in the first half talking about Sing a Simple Song as the fire track. Just to get a little bit more granular about this, do either of you have a favorite moment on the album?
Mine is at the end or almost the end of Don't Call Me... bleep and bleep, because about the aforementioned instrumentation, how it goes out and it turns into, to me, sort of a blend of like emotion, fire. It's the last, I think, 2 minutes of the song. Says a lot without the words being decipherable to me. It puts all the anger, all the frustration, all whatever he was trying to say on this song, that I'm getting it from both ends. That Don't Call Me N blank. I can say Whitey, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Don't Call Me N Whitey and Don't Call Me...
You can say both words, apparently. We can't say both words.
No, y'all can't.
I know.
You guys can't. But it takes all of that, all the feeling behind that, all the history behind that, all the slurs, and it puts it into a context that is just, it lets the music do the talking. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my favorite moments of the song, that it breaks into, you don't even really need to know what we have to say, but you can feel what
that vocoder thing he's doing. It's a lot of emotion in there, for sure.
There's a lot of emotion.
And that song's interesting. There's only one verse, I think, sung by Cynthia Robinson, and then there's nothing else. It's just... a weird song after that. There's chorus and then that jam, the like extended jams and stuff, but there's only that one verse,
right?
Which is, you don't realize that until I tell you that, I guess.
Yeah. How about you?
For me, it's the beginning of Sing a Simple Song. The guitar, the refrain, just that anticipation moment.
Yeah.
There's a small, there's a drum fill, some not like Stan, but there's just this moment where they're about to launch. And when you know that's coming, it's pretty fun. That gave me chills, even though I knew it was coming.
Oh, totally.
Man,
right. My chill moment, I thought was going to be the drum breakdown on Sing a Simple Song, which is the part that, as we were talking about earlier, everyone and their cousin has sampled. But there's actually a better one. And if we're going to compare like hair standing up in the back of the hand, tingly moments, this one comes out just a nudge over, which is the a similar drum organ breakdown that happens on We Can Make It If We Try. Just a little bit before, I guess it's right after the first chorus. So it's not just the drums. It's got to be about the organ, too, in connection with it. And shout out to Greg Errico on this, who, as the drummer, was just killing it on this LP, especially with the break beats. And I'm just going to go on a brief tangent, but I've always heard the story, and this might be completely apocryphal, that one of the reasons why Sly used more drum machine by the early 70s is because Greg got really annoyed at Sly just trying to get him in the studio at all hours. He stopped returning his calls. And so because Sly couldn't get a drummer in to work on some of the draft versions of the songs, he just started playing with the drum machine that was lying around the studio. And then he just realized this is not just a practice instrument for to make, you know, to just to have like a more sophisticated metronome. I can actually use this as a studio instrument, which is how Sly ends up pioneering the use of the drum machine.
Yeah, do you know, was that literally one of the first major releases?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there certainly would have been other examples of drum machines prior to that. Shuggy Otis around the same era was playing with it. But I think in terms of the stature of Sly Stone, he's got to be one of the major, major people who helped to introduce it. I think that was the Rhythm King. Exactly. But yeah, it's because Erica was like, stop calling me hooked out at 4 a.m. I'm not coming to the studio. And Sly's like, fine. I'm going to start pushing some buttons instead. How you
I
like
got my
that?
Robot drummer.
I don't need you.
Right.
Robot drummer is always here.
Right.
But I wanted to just name check a couple of the samples because you mentioned it's been sampled
a
lot.
Okay. Go in.
It has been sampled by, I didn't even know Jodeci had sampled it. Mm. Okay, great. Wu-Tang Clan, obviously, Public Enemy, De La Soul, Digital Underground on Humpty Dance.
The most important, I would argue.
The most important.
Because everyone used their flip on it.
After.
Yeah.
Right. Then we have Gorillaz, Arrested Development. Backstreet Boys, whatever.
Amazing.
Spice Girls, okay. And Adina Howard.
And Michael Bublé.
Right. Really?
No, I just
okay.
Made up.
I was like, that's not on here.
Just to be clear though, you're talking about Sing a Simple Song.
Sing a Simple Song.
Yeah, you're not talking about We Can Make It With
No,
Try, which a lot of other people have sampled that same break.
No, Sing a Simple Song that you mentioned earlier.
That song is so meaningful to me. I was talking about these songs where it's about like making you feel good or helping you through something, kind of. And that's a beautiful song. I mean, I lived in San Francisco when I was blasting this record a lot in my car. I was playing shows. I played shows not at the Fillmore Live stage, but they had like this beer room upstairs. I'd be playing there. Or across the street, there's a place called Boom Boom Room where my band would play every once in a while. We'd play Sing a Simple Song a lot, actually. And so a lot of memories listening to this record, driving down, if anybody knows SF, but driving down Geary through the Fillmore.
Yep.
Listening to that record a lot, really, really loud, screaming lyrics at my window.
What year was this?
Oh, this is 2000s.
Okay.
Yeah.
If we can revisit one of B's favorite moments that he just mentioned a minute ago, which is the beginning of Sing a Simple Song. And as we talked about also earlier, this song has been covered many times. But one of my favorite versions of it is not a cover because they didn't give it credit to Sly and the Family Stone, but it clearly, clearly is a cover, which is Ike and Tina Turner's Bold Soul Sister that opens basically identically to the song. Hey!
stop.
Not credited.
No, it's credited to Ike Turner. So of the many things besides domestic abuse that one can accuse, can look down on Ike Turner for, also just
songs
blatantly
tailored.
Ripping off Sly and the Family Stone and not giving them publishing
wow.
credit.
Gully.
I've always wondered if there was a legal suit around that, because Sly must have listened to this and be like, yo, that's like my song. What's going on here?
What year did you say it came out?
That came out in 69. So they did it in the same year. It's a dope song, too. I mean, Tina kills it. But
got to strike when the iron's hot, I guess.
Yeah,
but it got lifted. It got lifted.
Sometimes I'm right, and I can be wrong. My own beliefs.
We haven't talked about everyday people.
Yeah.
It's too obvious.
It is, and it's,
no, just kidding.
It's not my favorite song. It's a little
shame
boring
on,
to me.
Shame on both of you.
No, it's one of my favorite songs. I'll talk about it. You don't
okay.
know.
Okay. Go on, B. Go on, B. Your thoughts.
I mean, it is like, if you were going to call anything on this album corny, you might call this song corny. But I don't. It's one of those things where it's been overused to the point of corniness, where you forget how it was great. If it was just this gem of a song,
right.
it was great.
Right.
But it's been overused, for sure.
It's been overused.
But it's to me, it's like Stand, that. There's a giant beside him about to fall. It's filled with all these little lines like that. They're just beautiful. And it is this personal politics sort of thing. And you see it in their band. When you look at their band,
sure.
they are everyday people.
They're everyday people.
You know, it's like, we are everyone. We are you. And that resonated, obviously. Was it their biggest hit, or was something else was probably their biggest hit?
I think Family Affair might have been slightly bigger, but this would have certainly been like top five for them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are ways of looking at it that I mean, to your point, his band was multicultural, right? But I like this song, mm-hmm. and he does have some crazy lines in there, so on, and doobie doobie,
right? Shooby dooby doo, y'all.
And as when I was young, this was a song I could learn. It was two chords. I could learn it quick.
There
it
you go.
Like A, D, whatever, and you could. It's very simple, and that was probably a draw to me. But yeah, it's filled with amazing things like that.
It is. I mean, he's got some zingers in there that are crazy, but I do think in some ways I get his point of what he's trying to say, and so we are all the same and stuff. But it's a you go from Don't Call Me N Whitey to, you know,
yeah,
I'm also everyday people. So
kind of two sides of the same coin.
It is.
They're kind of saying the same thing,
sure,
just from very different directions.
Very different directions.
We got to live.
I think if I had to pick a similar song out of their catalog, Everybody is a Star appeals to me more. And it's less about any of the specific sentiments or the lyrics, though the shooby dooby doo, y'all, does.
That's classic material.
That's kind of great on me. But I think musically, Everybody is a Star is more pleasing to me. But it's not like, I'm not saying this is a bad song by any means, but it's also like, do I ever need to hear it again? Not really.
No, yeah, it is one of those, because it's been played so many times.
Right.
But it does have that chill moment of, we got to live together.
We got to live together.
That's a beautiful line.
I agree. Listening to it again right just now, I think the chorus is great, but it's a little too simplistic. Like, there's not a lot to hang your ear on.
Yeah.
It's got a little too much cowbell. I mean,
Will Ferrell, Will Ferrell in there on the cowbell.
And we should have said this earlier, but this is an album that really rewards you if you're listening to it with headphones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously a good hi-fi system, it's going to sound awesome as well, but just because of the level of panning and other things that Sly is trying to do in the studio with it, it helps to have the intimacy of the headphones to really appreciate everything that's happening within it.
For sure.
And everyone.
Yes.
And everyone individual. Yeah. Everyone's individual contribution.
And you guys have probably heard the thing of like, oh, this record, not this particular record, but somebody coming out with a new record, let's say, and they'll be like, this record will make you think and it'll make you dance or whatever. And it's like, this was doing that probably
true.
Before than anybody else was ever doing that.
Right.
So I think that's noteworthy for sure.
Mm. As a singer-songwriter yourself, I don't know if you've made it a habit to have ever covered other people's songs, but would you be willing to take a song on here? And if so, which one?
I was saying earlier that I used to be in a band, and we play at this place called Boom Boom Room right across
from the Boom Boom Room. Yeah, I know.
Ray's Boom Boom. No, it's not Ray's Boom Room, but it's just called the Boom Boom Room.
The Boom Boom Room.
And we played Sing a Simple Song a lot, and I loved playing that one. So I can already play that one. I know a lot of these, quite a bit of these songs. Stand is a very fun one to play the chords and sing to because it keeps you on your toes.
Are your covers loyal to the original, or are you twisting it up?
I usually twist it.
Okay.
Well, the Sing a Simple Song was within arm's reach.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But generally, when I do a cover, I don't love to just do it like it was done.
Right.
Like, I don't,
because what's the point?
Yeah. What's the point a little bit? Right. It's already been done good.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it worse if I try to do the same thing. So either somebody wants to hear how I, through my lens, wants to see what I can do with it, or they don't. So that's the way I do it.
Is this album right on time, ahead of its time, or is it timeless?
Ooh. It was right on time, and it's timeless. And ahead of its time.
That's cheap, man.
All those things you just said. All of the above. No, I would say, I don't know if it was ahead of its time, but it seemed to fit at that time.
Right.
And
certainly
it's
right.
Certainly timeless, I would say. Okay. I would just go with timeless.
Okay.
And all of the above.
Okay.
I think what's not up for debate is that Sly and the Family Stone made incredible contributions to American music. But in your opinion, what are the biggest contributions that Sly has made to music? If you had to take this album as a jump off.
Well, it's hard to underestimate the influence in beat making, let's say, and listening to Sly and some of the best beat makers around, loving Sly and getting influenced by that. But that's one genre. But I don't know. I mean, he's a singer-songwriter. When you think of singer-songwriters, you think of like white, brown, like long-haired California boys.
Sure.
But I think of Stevie Wonder or Bob Marley or Sly Stone or any as well as all those people. And his positivity is really something I've taken away. Obviously, he's talking about things that are not positive. He's thinking about things that are very difficult to wrap your head around. But he's choosing not to yell or scream or throw names or whatever, you know, say somebody else is at fault necessarily. It's a little bit about taking ownership. It's about taking care of yourself and taking care of what you can take care of. And I mean, obviously it's hippy dippy in a way. It's like love everybody else, which I'm not a hippie, but I believe fully in loving everybody unless they do you wrong. And like I said a thousand times earlier, it's a little bit of a self love album in a certain way. You can make it if you try. Not somebody's watching you. That's weird. But but there's a lot of uplifting things. Stand, Everyday People. These are all like things where it's like for the freaks and geeks, let's say, you know, a little bit. It's a little bit for them. And it's whenever those freaks and geeks can feel like they're part of a club, a part of a community or something, it's like that's a big deal in music for sure.
If you had to describe this album in three words, what would they be?
Funk. It's fun. It's political. And that those two things don't usually happen.
Mm. Funky, fun, and political.
Yeah.
I love it.
Look at that. That will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, B. Beeman. What are you working on right now?
My new album is a podcast, as you mentioned earlier. And the album, a lot of people are confused by this. They hear, oh, I'm making a podcast and think, oh, I want to be on like MSNBC or something. It's like, no, that's not the way I approached it. About a year ago, I completed an album and it's political. These times are
yeah,
political.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not my first political album, or it's something that is in me. Like, I care about social issues, not like politics in DC. I care about social issues is really what it is. And I've always written songs about it. I wrote a song about Huey Newton. I wrote a song about a lot of things, all kinds of things. Immigration. My last album was all about fear of immigrants, kind of like a fear of a brown planet, I guess, sort of thing. And so this is obviously, we live in a crazy Trump world right now. So it has to do with that. And it's hard to get your music heard these days, and I've found it hard to get your political music heard in a way that gets taken seriously. And my wife and I, who's also my manager, Katie Ross, she is a huge podcast fan, was a bigger podcast fan than I was before we got started talking about this. She's like, she's an addict.
A podcast addict.
Yeah, a lot of your fans are probably addicts and aren't paying attention to their children right now. She was the one who kind of convinced me that this was a great idea, and it is a great idea, and that like each song on my album has to do with something political, mm-hmm. and one is about immigration, but it's not about politics of immigration. It's about like people, a father mm-hmm. who has to go to Mexico, not even from Mexico, getting deported to Mexico, leaving his family behind. So it's all about personal stories and things like that. And so on that episode, for example, I'm talking to the senior counsel at the ACLU who goes and works on these immigration cases at the border, these deportation cases at the border. Another song is about voter suppression. And I talked to Dale Ho, also of the ACLU, who is leading the charge in those voter suppression cases in Kansas against Chris Kobach in North Carolina. These guys are on the front line. So the things I wanted to talk about were people on the front lines dealing with these things that I talk about in the song. So first episode, Glenn Washington and Dave Eggers. Check it out. I'm done talking about it, but it's cool.
And remind us the name of it again.
The name of the podcast. The name of the podcast is Peace of Mind with B. Beeman. Mm-hmm.
And where else can people find you online?
You can find me online at Beeman.com, BHIMAN.com, and Spotify, all these things.
Socials,
Twitter. B. Beeman, BHIBHIMAN on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, same thing, same handle. And yeah, check me out. Check us out here and check me out there.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess, one of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Soul Clappin' neighborhood of Los Angeles, the city where you can make it if you try. We also wanted to thank all of our social media fans and family out there, including the following folks. We want to thank Hadi Kadri. Thank you so much for the love there, for giving us a shout. We also want to shout out Jesse Thorne for putting people up on our episode about Bill Withers' adjustments. We want to thank Heartbreak a la Mode for the shout. We also want to thank Andrew Miller. We want to thank Who Shot You for giving us some love. Thank you, Who Shot You. We also want to thank Inside Pop. We want to thank Frederick Smith. We want to thank Andy Larson, and we also want to thank New Nikes 2018. All right, shout out to New Nikes. That's a new one. We also want to thank Lizzie Criolla. Thank you so much for the tweezies and the retweezies. We also want to salute and thank you so much everyone who donated to Heat Rocks during the Maximum Fun Pledge Drive. We do so appreciate your support. It goes without saying we cannot do this show without you. So thank you for standing in the gap for us, for showing up for us. We do so appreciate your support. Thank you so much. One last thing. Here's a teaser for next week's episode. Future soul pioneer Cy Smith on Michelle Indegeocello's seminal debut album, Plantation Lullabies. When this album came out, I know you talked about being in the band, but where were you as an artist?
As an artist, I was still formulating myself. Like, I don't even think I knew I was an artist back then. I knew I was a musician. Okay. I knew I was a songwriter. I was a junior at Howard, right? I think I was a junior or a sophomore. And I was a psychology major, so music therapy was my minor. I know, right? And you know what else I was doing? I had a friend named Scotty Beats, who was an engineer at Night Flight Studios, and Scotty used to bring me in to demo other people's songs. Oh, so I was learning how to record. I was learning how to record in the studio, and I became that girl that sang other people's. I became the demo girl because I could imitate a lot of people. Mm. And at the time, people would be like, we're writing this song for Janet. I could sing just like Janet.
Can we hear your Janet Jackson circa 1992, 93 impression?
Cold game out here.
I'm just curious what that, I'm trying to imagine like a singer imitating another singer. Like, how does that,
Okay, you got to name a song because I don't have it.
That's the way love goes.
Oh baby, I'm like candle. And I not like what you like.
That's it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.